I want to start with a story. This was a lot of fun. Last year, I had the opportunity to write a weekly essay that was published by Gush, by Shiva Haratzion, right, for their virtual Beit Midrash. So I'm doing it again this year. It's a lot of fun. And people from all over the world subscribed and asked me all sorts of really interesting questions and saying, this makes no sense, Rabbi, and hi, it's nice to meet you. And I don't understand anything that you're talking about here. We have a lot of fun with that. But it's really been great. It's been very rewarding with the number of people in the community also who follow and subscribe, etc. So last year I was working on a series of essays having to do with the return to Israel, the Second Temple period. Shivat Zion, it's called, that time period. And looking specifically at the final sections of Tanakh, which is really fascinating. That time period, the Jews are called back from Babylonia by the Persian emperor, by Cyrus, a famous declaration, and the Jews come back, and all the challenges with rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash. And it was coming up around Hanukkah time, or at least I was writing about something that I thought would be relevant to publish around Hanukkah time for that series. And I started thinking about, in that context, and I'll explain why in just a moment, the symbol of the State of Israel. Let's take a look on the second side. You'll see something very familiar, at least the one on the top. And it's the modern-day symbol of Israel. And in that context, and I'll explain why in a moment, I got started thinking about what's the symbolism, this very appropriate emblem for Hanukkah, because you have the menorah in the middle, and you have a very interesting base to that menorah, and then you have the olive branches surrounding it, and I was wondering kind of where this comes from. I kind of started getting curious and exploring this. First of all, anyone know? Yeah, the bottom comes from where? The bottom comes the archetypes. That's pretty straightforward. But what's the basis for the design? Who designed it? Where did this come from? You see it all over in Israel. It kind of got my wheels turning. I'll explain again the connection to the return to Israel in that section of Tanakh in just a few moments. But I started to do some research, and I saw in an article online that in the Israeli newspaper Ma'ariv on February 19th, 1949, there was an article that was published about this topic, about where this came from. And I was really curious. And I'm not, I don't do too much speed work in terms of a historian, but every once in a while, if there's something that catches my fancy, I'll go and try to do some research. So I started looking for it, and I finally found online, they have, through the National Library in Israel, the old archives of all of these old newspaper journals from the first years of the state. And so I went online. They have all of these archives. You can just scroll through them online. And I finally found a copy of February 19th, 1949. Worked through the Hebrew, and I found it. And I was so excited to find the article with an interview with the individuals who actually were responsible for this emblem. And I go, and I look, and I find it online, and I'm searching, and I don't know. I don't want to even imagine or try to recall how many hours I spent going through every single page of that daily newspaper. It was unbelievable. And I couldn't find anything. I was so frustrated because I had read an article online. It was a very authoritative article written by a scholar, a historian, and everything. Tried to contact the author. I couldn't get through, couldn't find anything. Where in the world is this article? So I finally emailed the curator of this collection at the National Library in Israel, and he says basically the equivalent of librarians. You know how in Israel, if you're asking directions somewhere, and they always answer, right? Yeah, Yashar, yes, the shop. He gave me the librarian's equivalent of that. He's like, well, look at close dates or something. I can't really help you. Like, thank you. Really appreciate that. So, you know what? At first, I was really annoyed, and then I said, you know what? He's just being Israeli. And then I finally said, you know what? Maybe he's right. Maybe he's onto something. Maybe he wasn't just pushing me off. And I really do need to look at close dates. And if he won't look at them for me, maybe I can just look myself. So I looked the next day, and I looked the next week. And instead of the 19th, maybe it was 29th, or maybe it was the 9th, or something like that. Or maybe it was the wrong year. So it's 1950, and I went back to 1948, and there was barely a newspaper at that time. There wasn't any of those. It turns out, actually, it was the day before. So I found it on February 18th, which is in Israel, they say 18/02/1949. So I found an 1802, 1949, an article about this in Ma'ariv. There was a parallel article in Haaretz because this was about a week after the State of Israel accepted this symbol as the official symbol of the State of Israel. So it was a number of months after the founding of the state. So it was founded in May 1948. By the time you come to February 1949, about 9 months later, you have the acceptance of this symbol. And I actually gave you, I could not have a tremendous amount of trouble getting reading it in the proper size. So it's going to be basically impossible to read it, but I want you to know it's authentic, and I'm going to summarize it. So if you take a look, you can see just barely, if you get out your magnifying glass, you can't see the date, but you can see Ma'ariv, and you can see a couple of interesting things about it. For example, if you look at the bottom right, you see where it says Iton Erev? Okay, so this is the evening edition, right? Okay, so that you see. You see Ha'orech, who's Dr. Azriel, Karlbar?
Karlbar?
I know, is it Karlbach? I couldn't tell. Maybe it's Karlbach. What?
Amiel Karlbach.
Oh, Amiel, you think it is? Okay, I can't really. Okay, I thought it was a Zion and a Resh.
Maybe you might be right.
Anyhow, it's hard to say. Hamotzi Laor, it says, right under that, it's very small. Hayotzei Modi'in. And then it's got all this stuff. It doesn't even say the date. What I thought was kind of interesting is that I found that it's Shana Shnia. If you look all the way on the left, it gives you the middle is just like the dates, you know, the places where they publish it. So there's Tel Aviv and Yerushalayim, right? So it was it's a small country, but travel wasn't what it is today. So they had all the different locations where they published and distributed it, right? You have Chifa on the bottom left there. And if you go to the left from there, the second to left box there, it says Shana Shnia Gilyon, I think it's 470. And then for us English readers, Ma'ariv. How many English readers there were in Israel in 1949, but that's what they included. And Hamechir, right? Mm-hmm. What is that? So I think it's, right? It's what?
30 mil.
Right?
It's like a cent.
Yeah, right?
30 cents.
And that was, they were using the lira, right? Back then was the currency.
Mil.
But it was on the lira currency. Is that right? They weren't on shekel yet. Or did
no,
they
start? No, it was shekel.
What? There was no shekel yet.
It was a lira, it was a pound.
Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, something, so that's the curtains. This is going. So it's I think that comes. I don't know exactly what that comes out to, but I promise you, it's a lot less than whatever the New York Times costs today. Of course, today most people get the news for free online, but that's a different conversation. There's literally no one in my generation who's willing to actually pay to read the news anymore. So I'm really trying to open this conversation with anyone. Pay for a newspaper? That's just inconceivable.
I pay to the Times and the Wall Street Journal.
Times is for free, man. The Wall Street Journal has to pay for it.
Yeah.
Right. No, Times is not free anymore.
Times was free,
but now they, about three, four years ago.
After you get 10 articles.
Yeah, and then everyone in my generation has figured, you know, the trick
free
is?
Free email, so you can...
Please, if you go to the article, you close out from it, and then you Google it, they come up for free. You get like up to 30 or something. You get like a ton of them. I've heard this from...
The experts.
People have figured these things out. The same people who learned how to download all the music, Napster, all those people. Anyhow, that's actually the policy. If you get it through a search engine, you go on. Anyhow, all right. So if you take a look at the next page, this is very cool. This is actually a copy of the article. Again, a little small to read, but it starts to give us some sense of the details. So it says, Kach nolad semel medinat Yisrael. This is how the emblem of the state of Israel came into existence. This is one of the coolest things that I've ever found. It's only a second to what was brought to my attention by J.J. Schachter, who brought to my attention that the deliberations for Yom HaShoah in the Knesset are all available for free online in the Knesset archives. They've all been made available. So you can actually see the deliberations between the different Haveri Knesset and the different committees to the subcommittees. It's like all boards are constructed, right? You have a subcommittee that has to report back to the larger committee, report back to the board, back to the executive board, etc. So there's actually, you can see these conversations and tease out the history of the debates internally over Yom HaShoah. It's really very cool. Anyhow, so second to that, this is one of the most remarkable funds from Israeli archives, at least for me personally. And they have the picture in the middle. It didn't come out so well, but you can see these two people. And if you read the caption right underneath, it says, Ha'achim Shamir Ba'avodatam. The Shamir brothers in their work. What was the story? The designers was these two brothers, Gavriel and Maxim Shamir, or these Israeli artists who won an open competition that had been publicized by the State of Israel, and they submitted their particular design, and they ultimately won the competition. And that was the story. And this is an interview with them about a week after they won, and this was accepted. There was at least one revision that I'll speak about in a moment. This is actually an interview with them. This will give you a sense of what's on people's minds. If you take a look at the bottom article here, Kacha Zehaya, and that is Sefer, I think it's Sefer, Al Churban Ghetto Varsha. So this is, right, this is 1949, right? They're just discovering everything that had happened. And so you have this. So I think it's really interesting because I've heard a lot of discussion about how the conversations around the Holocaust really began in earnest, not immediately. But I wonder if that's really true. This is just a random, it's not a representative sample, but I wonder if maybe some of the philosophizing around it maybe started later, maybe some of the survivors started to open up a little bit later, not immediately, but I do wonder if some of the conversations already had begun in Israel, at least. This was a significant percentage, or not that high.
Supposedly it was the Eichmann trial that allowed people to start.
So that's what I always heard, but that obviously comes.
Exactly.
That's, right? So right. That obviously, six, they, right, the trial was in 61, I think it was. Going. Right, but I wonder if it's a little bit more subtle than that. I wonder if there's more that's being cut. Because you expect, it sounds very generalized, very simplistic almost. Right? No one was talking about it until the 1960s. That seems a little bit much. Maybe it was more nuanced. I wonder aloud. Anyhow, so this is a picture of them working, and I won't torture everyone by attempting to make our way through the fine print with a fine comb. But basically, they were asked essentially how they came to this design and how the process went about. So here's basically what they said. The State of Israel had already recommended, at least as a significant candidate, the menorah as one element in the design. I don't think they required it, was what I understood from reading this article, but they had at least recommended it. And so the Shamir brothers were interested in this. They were, these are secular but culturally religious Zionist artists who grew up in Eastern Europe and then came over, and they had won prizes already back in Europe, and they had already won some sort of prize here in Israel. Before the founding of State, I think they were well-recognized artists in terms of their craft work. So they were asked this question, what did they consign? So they said the first thing that they did was that they studied the designs of every other country in existence in 1948, 1949. And they said, and I don't get this, maybe it's changed since then, they said that no one else had a menorah, so they liked that because it distinguished us as unique. And they said that the other possible candidate, the Magen David, they said Liberia. Had that emblem, they didn't want to go there. Now I've looked at Liberia's emblem, and I don't know. I don't remember them again. They have 5 stars on it, a 5-point star. I didn't go through the history. Yeah. Right, so that's what I assume, but I didn't get a chance to get that far. Anyhow, so that was one point that they made. So they decided to stick with the menorah. So they said, what kind of menorah? That was one question that they had to ask, and what else? Was there anything else? So they liked the idea of the olive branches, and they said that symbolizes peace. So that was the intention of the State of Israel. They wanted to be a peaceful civilization, community, nation, state, etc. So that's how they came to that, flanking the menorah on either side. And one of the menorah said their initial design was a modern, sleek menorah. And they said the reason was because they wanted to find a balance between the traditional and the new, the old and the new. And the menorah, in of itself, they said, is a traditional symbol. That's why it's being used. So designing essentially a modern kind of menorah design that would strike that balance between tradition and the new nation state that was Medina Israel. So that was their idea. They sent that design back to the committee, and they said, nonsense. They said, I want none of it. You're going to make it with an old design, with a traditional design. Now, it's interesting that they chose the one from the Arch of Titus, because the Arch of Titus is not always known as the most traditional, quote-unquote, I'm going to explain what I mean by this in a moment, forms of the menorah, by which I mean there are some who have been uncomfortable or expressed a significant discomfort with the design of the Arch of Titus because it doesn't seem to be a replica of what you have in the Beis HaMikdash. Because it's not the design that the Torah sets out, it's not the design that we have from earlier generations, etc. In fact, the Lubavitcher Rebbe actually classically opposed the rounded branches of the menorah in the public design. Right, if you think about the Chabad menorahs, we find in public squares, they're always diagonal.
Yeah,
right, they're always never rounded.
The Chabad held that was the appearance of the menorah in the
Well, that was part of it, but I've read a letter from the Rebbe, and the Rebbe believed that how can it be, an additional argument that he offers, how can it be that we're going to take this, our cue from a pagan symbol, and not just a pagan symbol, but a symbol of the Churban. Right, they're celebrating the destruction of Jerusalem, just 1 second. And so they... so it's just ironic that the committee went back to them and said, no, we want a traditional symbol, you need to use the Arch of Titus menorah. But on the other hand, you can understand it because it's an archaeological finding. In other words, it's a representation of what there was, which is, I think, very interesting. There's some different theories. That's a whole other shiur in its own right. Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik has an interesting article, interesting theory about it, but that's one part of the story.
In Roman times, before the destruction, the symbol of Israel was a date palm. And from the time of about the first century through 7th, 6th, 7th, 8th century in Israel and in Rome, the symbol of the Jews was a menorah with the curved thing, 7 branches, not 8, mm-hmm. usually mm-hmm. with a tripod base.
Right.
A tripod base. The only menorah that I know of with an octagonal base with sea creatures and things on it is the one on the Arch of Titus, the mm-hmm. traditional one that was in every tomb, mm-hmm. every wall was a menorah,
yeah.
7 branches with a tripod base. And the Magen David didn't come into use.
Circular.
Like this.
Yeah, that's right. All the archaeological evidence is consistent with that.
Every tomb, every tomb mm-hmm. in the catacombs.
That's right.
The Magen David didn't, as far as I know, didn't become to be a symbol of the Jews until the early medieval period, maybe 13th, 14th century.
I think maybe a few hundred years before that.
But early medieval period.
That's right.
So in every way, using the menorah as a symbol of the Jews is authentic. The only thing that's not is the octagonal base thing, which is only the Arch of Titus. All the other ones mm-hmm. are tripod base.
Right.
And every tomb that I've ever seen in right. that period. So
yeah, that's right. Started. Yep. So that was exactly part of the conversation. So that's what they said, and it was an interesting article. Although they didn't really say a ton, they just kind of said they wanted the menorah was given to them. They had the back and forth about which menorah that design they would use. They added the olive branches, and that's kind of where they leave it. They didn't really say very much. Okay, so I had that kind of, I learned that information, but I learned it in context of my study of Shivat Zion, and I didn't buy it. Now, when I say I didn't buy it, I don't necessarily mean that they were only thinking of what they said. I can't speak for them. They weren't necessarily Jewishly knowledgeable. I really don't know how much they knew Jewishly or not. But what I mean I don't buy it is I think that there's clearly a deeper symbolism and a very particular reference, and that's what I want to look at and contextualize it tonight, and to suggest that I think it's fairly straightforward that whether it was their intention or not, the fact of the symbol of the menorah flanked by olive branches has a very specific imagery and a very specific reference point in Tanakh, and it's not just any reference, but it's specifically the Haftorah that appropriately was chosen by Chazal for Shabbos Hanukkah. It's what we're going to read this coming Shema, God willing. So that's what I want to start to explore. So let me show you what I mean. We're going to start with Zechariah Perek Dalet, and then I'm going to give you some background. But let me just start by showing you the psukim that I'm reading, and I'm preparing the shirim while I'm researching and reading this article. I'm looking at this image, and I'm saying, it can't just be what they say in the interview. It must be something more. So where am I coming from? So you take a look at Zechariah. Again, we'll explain his context in just a few moments. But he talks about a prophecy with which he was presented. Vayashav hamalach adover bi, Perek Dalet Pasuk Aleph in Zechariah, on page 3. So the angel that had previously spoken to me, says the Navi, came back to me, returned. Vayi'ireni, woke me up. Yesh ha'sheyo mishnato, a man that's weakened out of his sleep. Vayomer elai, he said to me, ma ataroeh? Right, so this is like a test, right? What do you see in front of you? V'omar, and I said, Ra'iti, says I see, V'hine, behold, Menorat Zahav Kula, you have this candlestick, this menorah entirely comprised of gold, V'gula Rosha, with a bowl on the top of it, V'shivani Roteh Aleho, with 7 lamps on top. Then you have these 7 pipes, right? The branches of the menorah. And here's the kicker. Pasuk Gimel, look at this, right? It's unbelievable. Ushnayim zeitim aleha, right? You have 2 olives on it. Echad mimina galav yechad al smola, one on this side and one on the other side. Right, and he says to Malach, he says, I'm sorry, I'm a failed student, I can't get it. Right, this is like a conversation with the student, and Shelley knows about this. Right, the student who feels like he or she just can't get it, I can't get the answer, what am I going to do next? So he says, you tell me the answer. Well, I get this, by the way, from students in the middle of my tests and quizzes. Right, Rabbi, I'm not really sure about this, but I'm just wondering, and then they ask the leading question. All right, how dumb are you, Rabbi? That's basically what they're asking. Pasuk, hey, okay. Vayan, it's really Fine. So pasuk hey vayana malach adaver bi vayomer elai and he said to me al yodata mehayim eila, right? So this is like me talking back to my students, like says, not only can I not tell you the answer on the test, but like if you look deeply enough, if you dig, I believe in you, right? I think you have the answer within. That's what the Malach says. It's a beautiful exchange. But Omar, he says, Lord. He says, no, right? He says, no, I actually don't know anything. Right? So much for that. I kind of ruins it. So I don't know, Yom Rei Lai Fai Shmar. He says, okay, this time I'm going to tell you the answer, but next time I'm not going to. And he said, what does it mean? Zed Var Hashem Zerubbabel Limor. This is the word of God to Zerubbabel saying, who Zerubbabel will see soon. Lo V'chaya, beautiful and classic pasuk. Lo V'chaya V'lo V'choach, not by army, not by brute strength. Ki im beruchi amar Hashem tzvakotz, rather by my spirit, says God. And then this unusual pasuk, Miatar gadol ethnei Zerubbabel mishur. What are you, you great mountain before Zerubbabel? You're going to become flattened. It's like imagery in Yeshayahu. At the end of days, the Kadosh Baruch Hu is going to come and just simply sweep through all of nature and flatten all the mountains and make upright all the valleys. Similar kind of imagery. Votzia to Evan Horoshan, he will have to explain this imagery. He will bring out the head stone to Shuot Chin Chin La, which have these callings of grace, shoutings of grace. And then it continues and says that the hand of Zerubbabel will actually establish the foundation for this building. This building being a reference to right, the second temple, exactly. And then it says, Pasukir at the bottom, ki mevaz yom ktanot. Who despises the small days? People will see it, they'll see this the stone in the hand of Zerubbabel, and they'll be happy with it. He says stones represent the eyes of God, and we'll have to explain what that means. So I'm reading these psukim in Zechariah, and you have the description of the menorah, and it's flanked by the olive branches on each side. And I'm kind of flipping back and forth, and I'm saying, whoa, this is the Haftorah, this, right? I say, again, I have no idea if they were comfortable saying this publicly, or who knows, I don't know why they wouldn't have been, but maybe at that time it wasn't popular, I don't know, although in those circles Tanakh was right there, I mean, they saw it, so maybe they really didn't know, they didn't appreciate
the fact that
they were interviewed, and same thing in Haaretz, and they were asked, where did it come from? And they said, well, we were given the menorah and we thought that the olive branches would be a nice symbol of peace. And that's all they were willing to say. And I'm trying to figure out.
You mean to sell it more broadly?
Right, but in Israel, that was broad. You mean more broadly than Israel? This is an Israeli daily. Who else is reading Hebrew, you know?
I don't tell you why when we learned this, we were told that this was the source of the symbol.
This is.
So that's how we were taught.
I think I think it's MS in one way or another, exactly. Right? Whether it's the historical truth that that's what was motivating them, or it's just, I think it's, you know, or maybe that the committee found it so compelling for that reason.
But they also could have been exposed to it and not even realized.
Yeah. That's smart. That's a great point. I like that.
Because it's part of the cultural
movement. Yeah, that's close to the cultural Zionism.
In those years, the Chilohim had
all...
And
they had all grown up from, right. You know.
But even...
Now the Chilohim is three generations later. They know some of them know Gurnish and Gurnish. But back then, they still...
May be, Seth, but the Frum circles in Europe weren't exactly learning a lot
true.
Of Tanakh.
It's not true. Rabbi did not grow up in Europe, and he grew up in Israel, and he knew the Bible by heart.
It's also true a lot by that time when a lot of them were growing up. Many people were no longer from Eastern Europe. Things had collapsed by the early 20th century.
They knew the basic liturgy.
But also the Tanakh was an integral part of the curriculum for all the schools in Israel.
Right.
It's
making a comeback now.
Everyone knew Tanakh.
All these Tanakh study circles and all these things. Yeah, 100%. The legendary ones with Ben Gurion and now. Sure, yeah, absolutely, 100%. So yeah, that might be it. That's an excellent suggestion. So what I want to explore a little bit is I think it's like that's QED. In other words, I think it's crystal clear, as I say in math, that's the connection, that's where it comes from, that's the source. But I think what remains is to figure out what's the significance of this prophecy of Zechariah? How do we understand it internally with it in its own context? Question one, then question two. Once we appreciate that, what symbolism might that lend? What deeper appreciation might we have then in turn for the Semel Yisrael, and how does this all come back to the holiday of Hanukkah? So that's sort of what I want to do for the rest of our time. So to get there, so let's start with understanding Zechariah internally, and then we'll come to the connection to Medina Israel, and perhaps along the way Hanukkah as well. Because again, Chazal are drawing the connection. They're pointing us to this imagery of the menorah as the Haftorah that we read. Obviously, there's something going on there as well. All right, so just a little bit of historical context, although we've already given it. So essentially, at this time, the Jews had been called back from Babel, but of course, the percentage of Jews and the sheer quantity of Jews who return is relatively small. It's not exactly a groundswell of Jews who come. There are a couple of waves of Aliyah, but in total, we have maybe 10% roughly of the Jewish population in Babel want to come back. Some have suggested that, in fact, this entire pattern is a social criticism, which mirrors, as we sit here in the diaspora, mirrors perhaps some of the shortcomings of our generation, some have suggested. But be that as it may, it's very clear that it's a relatively small amount, that it's probably a total of maybe 50,000 Jews who come back. There had been a handful who remained. There was never a time in Jewish history from the time that Jews set foot in Yerushalayim that Yerushalayim was not inhabited by some number of Jews, but it was an exceedingly small number, and at that, they were poverty-stricken, and they were stricken by anti-Semitism, and it was the lowest class of society that remained. Those were the ones the Babylonians didn't even bother to exile, because they had no political interest in doing so, and they were joined by these others who returned, and so you have about 50,000 in all who were led by, first by one wave that includes Zerubbabel, which is exactly this reference, and then you have Ezra and Nehemiah leading their own aliyah as well. And so this context is right around the time, again, of we're about probably 50 years or so after the initial exile to Babylonia, or to after the destruction of the second of the first Beis HaMikdash, to be precise, and then around that time, before the second Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt, that's where these prophets are prophesying. That's the time frame that we're talking about. And the prophets essentially turn to the Jewish people at this time. So a lot of back and forth. If you take a look at the whole story is recorded in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, in Ezra in particular, and there is a lot of back and forth at this time. But essentially what happens is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu sends these prophets to go and to raise the spirits of this lowly Jewish community, because they had barely any leadership. They felt impoverished. They were beset by anti-Semites, by the Shomonim and others in the land of Israel, who sought these populations, sought to stop the Jews at all costs from going ahead with this rebuilding project. So what was going to happen was, essentially, these people were giving up. It felt like they had nothing going for them. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu sends Nevi'im to urge them to go ahead, to continue with this rebuilding process. And the first one, the Nevi'im, that's recorded is the Navi of Haggai. And if you take a look at Haggai, I gave that to you over here. So jump for a moment to source Vav, source 6. That's on page 4. So the Navi Haggai, he is charged essentially what he does. It's just two chapters. It's relatively straightforward, it's relatively short. And Haggai essentially tells the Jews, he says, don't give up hope, roll up your sleeves, he says to the people, you can do this. It's like a pep talk. And it's not even a spiritualized pep talk. It's obviously, it's divinely inspired. But it's purely, it's almost like straight political Zionism. Right? It's unbelievable. You read Haggai, you feel like you're reading one of the early Zionists. It says, roll up your sleeves, get your hands dirty, get to work, you can do this. If you push forward, you can go ahead and you're going to succeed. You'll see Zechariah is the spiritual Zionist. He's the religious Zionist. I don't mean to say, God forbid, that Haggai is not a religious Zionist, but I do mean to say that their messages were complementary. One focuses on the material, the other focuses on the spiritual, and I think they complemented each other in gorgeous ways. And so Haggai says some interesting things. So for example, after calling on the Jews to return and to do the work, that they can do this, they can succeed, right? That, by the way, that echoes the verse that we just already saw in Zechariah, Kimi vaz liyom ktano, who scorns these days of small beginnings. And by the way, if you want some great divrei Torah on this, Stephen Weiner has actually published articles on the topic of this particular pasuk. He has a whole other theory where he connects these verses to Sukkot. I understand that he's writing a series of essays on this on the side, just for fun. He's got other connections. But he has published on the connection to Sukkot, because the Nevi'im here, Haggai specifically, Haggai to Sukkot. Here's why, right? What do we do on Hoshana Rabbah? Right, beat the aravot. Anyone ever think this is one of the more bizarre Jewish rituals? I mean, we've got plenty of unusual minhagim that require some explanation, but it's still. And did you ever see the videos on YouTube that are going around? These guys, like these humorous videos. You've got the like mega aravot that are like, you know, 10 feet tall and like 3 feet wide. You see this, and the guys like this in the shul. I mean, it's great. So this is, I mean, that's just kind of a way of embellishing the oddity of the whole thing. What is this all about? So Stephen pointed out take a look at the book of Haggai on the same date of Hoshana Rabbah, on the 21st day of the 7th month, i.e., the day of Hoshana Rabbah. That's Tishrei. Wow. Tishrei is the 7th month, because Nisan in Tanakh is the first month, generally. So it's literally in Hoshana Rabbah. There's a Nevuah describing how God will come and he will pound, as it were, on the ground and cause this earthquake by bringing things down. And Esenfi Hirashdi at Kol Haaretz, it describes basically beating on the ground, pounding on the ground, as a sign for the Ge'ulah, the redemption that's going to come for this generation. And that's actually, so you suggest that's exactly, we're reenacting it. And the whole message of the book of Haggai is that even a partial redemption can still be a meaningful step toward redemption. Because the Jews felt nebi, they felt like this is not going anywhere. And the point is, no, that beginning, that's those small steps toward redemption that we take can lead to something much greater. And we recall that on Hoshana Rabbah every year. And we say the same thing is true of our time as well. We might think that whatever steps we're taking in our own generation are meaningless, but actually these anticipate. These can be the harbingers, ultimately, of Geula. So redemption can start with some very small symbols and very small actions and ultimately lead to something very glorious. So that's his suggestion, which I think is beautiful and I think is MS. I think it's very convincing. You can find it online. It's there if anyone's interested. You can just ask him. And I've seen all other suggestions linking Chagai, as we'll see, to the holiday of Chanukah. That is right. That's another Dvar Torah. That's my Dvar Torah on the connection. Go, because they're connections to Sukkot, their connections to Chanukah, and their connections to Elul. In the beginning of Tishrei. And a number of his prophecies were delivered on a number of key dates, including the first day of Elul. Right, where do we get this idea that El is the first day of Tshuva? Haggai calls on the Jews to engage in Tshuva and to move ahead with the building project on Rosh Chodesh Elo. And I think this is the biblical source. This is where Chazal were drawing on when they said, blow the shofar, it's the beginning of the Tshuva season, it's Mamash Chagai. And there's more. Wait, the 24, by the way, I was just adding.
24 to the 6 months.
It says the 9th month.
No, Peter.
No, we're going to come to that. You're on the different source. You're in the Chanukah Dvar Torah. All right, you're cheating. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, but this one.
We're on page 6.
Okay.
But this one says, Isol v'Abba b'chodesh b'shishi.
Yeah, that's the 6 month. That's Elul.
Ken.
Right, Nachon.
No, because you said Sukkot.
That's a different one. Oh, I didn't give that to you. I didn't give you the whole sefer. Sorry, that's also true. No, but don't apologize, because that's the 24th day of Elul, which is, according to one view in the Rishonim, we actually start saying Slichot on the 25th. Not that day, the 25th. It's very close. But you know, in Gematria, you can be one day off. So that's the Ran, Rabbi Nissim of Girona, one of the Spanish Rishonim, actually says that you can. If it were just that, I would be a little more skeptical. But on Aleph Elul, he uses the language of Tshuva. I mean, it's too good to be true. It's quite, and then the connection to Hoshana Rabbah, which according to the Hasidic tradition is the last day of the Tshuva season. This is mind-boggling. I mean, this is really it's hard to miss. What? We're getting it from the Kabbalistic tradition. Well, that's where it comes from. Kabbalistic, I should say. Well, that's where it comes from, the Kabbalistic tradition, and that's, it comes from Kabbalah Sahari in particular. That's where that became popular. So that's a huge piece of it. So that's really cool. And then if you take a look, so here in source 6, so there you have Zerubbabel and other personalities. The same Zerubbabel who's considered to be the monarch of this new kingdom that the Navi anticipates. It talks about God inspiring his ruach, which is the same word ruach, which explicitly links to ki im biruchi, my spirit. He's inspired by the ruach of Hashem. It talks about them doing the work of God. That's the subject. It goes back to the same thing. And then if you go to source 7, so here I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but if you take a look, you'll notice that yes, this last prophecy of the book of Haggai, the last two, were both delivered on essentially the day before Chanukah. Right, which is striking. Again, it's one day off, but it's Chav, Hey, Kislev.
Going back to the,
right, Tishrei, Cheshvan, Kislev, if you do the math. Wait, hold on one second.
Zerubbabel, that's the same one that's mentioned in Maltor.
Yeah, exactly. That's where it comes from. That's right, that's the reference. Yes. Yeah, that's right.
This is happening 400 years before Chanukah happened.
That's right.
You should be having children
down your spine.
Oh, 100%. So,
but you're not going to let that happen, are you?
Oh, good.
This is,
that's right. Oh, yeah, that's right. And Hanukkah happens around right around this time. And I think what Chazal are doing is they're linking it back to a notion of a period on the calendar that goes long before the events of Hanukkah. And it's not just this, but that's a whole other shir also in its own right. Many have suggested that actually Hanukkah comes from an ancient notion that there's a solstice holiday, and it's a time of darkness, right. And that you have in many traditions. And the Gemara in Avodah Zarah alludes to that idea, because the Gemara in Avodah Zarah talks about the idea that Adam Arishon thought that it was the first time it got dark, it was never going to get light again, and he made a yontif afterward. And that's probably an allusion to this larger notion that at this time of darkness, just when the time of whether that night moving into dawn or the season, that there's going to be a restoration of the spring, that that is a time of celebration. It's when we need that pick-me-up, and it's when we turn back toward that pick-me-up. So I think, yeah, I think Hanukkah is picking up on prior strands, and there are two major ones. There's that whole tradition, and then there's this.
You don't
as
have
well.
That meteorite. So
yeah. You don't
there's
have
no,
that.
There's no holiday in the Torah.
Right, no, not suggesting.
There's no holiday in the Torah, and anything related to the solar
I'm not suggesting otherwise. I'm with you. Yes. What? Just saying. It's an assertion of fact. I heard that Seth agrees with you. Okay. All right. And now it's even on the recording. Okay. All right. So good. So yeah. So these final two. What? That's it. I think censor is the proper term. No, it's going straight to YU Torah. Don't you worry. Okay, so on the 24th, in fact, if I get it up soon enough, it might be featured on YU Torah. All right, so on the 24th day of Kislev, so you have these last two prophecies, and those fit in as well. And if you take a look at Pasuk Chaf from toward the bottom of page 5, you'll see Vayhi Dvar Hashem Shineta Chagai. God comes to Chagai a second time on that same day, right? So if he missed it the first time, he's coming back to him again on that same day. Martin, this is the 24th day of the 9th month, i.e. Kislev, and more El Zerubbabel, and here it kind of ties together everything we've said already, Pachat Yudah Lemor, say to Zerubbabel, the governor of Yudah, saying, Ani Mar Ish et HaShemayim et HaRetz, which is just Chagai, it's just going back to what he mentioned in the first chapter, as I mentioned earlier, V'hafachti Kisei Mamlachot, I will uproot or I will overturn the thrones of kingdoms, Ashmati Chozek Mamlachot HaGaviyim, in other words, essentially going to cause some cataclysm and all sorts of interesting events. On that day, I'm going to essentially give my signet ring and establish Zerubbabel. There's a big machloket. Is this contemporaneous this time? Is this an allusion to the Messianic era? Is Zerubbabel a reference to Mashiach? And Brian, that's in most Tzur, is all about the first five stanzas are all about God coming and saving us over the course of different holidays throughout our history. Right. It's not really particularly about Hanukkah. It's really about God coming to us in different times of struggle, exile, etc. And then the last one, Chasof Zerah Kadshecha, is about anticipating Messianic era. It's actually a later addition to the song, but it all connects to this idea. It works out very nicely. Okay, so clearly Chagai is fitting nicely into this and is connecting to the holiday of Hanukkah, and I think the Ruach all connects to this. So that's one piece to the puzzle. And then the second piece to the puzzle is to go back to Zechariah. So Zechariah, again, is now we have some really helpful context, and we've seen his counterpart prophet, Chagai. If Chagai is about physical redemption, is about the work toward rebuilding the temple, then Zechariah is about the spiritual redemption. And he's about Ki'im Beruchi purely. He's about do tshuva. In other words, spiritual repentance will be the counterpart to the physical effort and investment that we engage in, and that will also bring about the redemption that will ensure that the Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt and so on and so forth. That's the whole vision of Zechariah. And if you go back to chapter 3 of Zechariah, so I'm going back to source 4 now, you'll see the larger context. And there are a couple of fascinating things that I think tie in not only to Hanukkah, but to the modern state of Israel that I think will help us wrap together the different strands here, understand what A, Chazal were doing, and then B, by extension, perhaps the meaning of the symbolism and the menorah in terms of the modern state of Israel. So here we come to two other pieces to the prophecy of Zechariah that tie in beautifully and very powerfully, I think, to Hanukkah and by extension to Medina Israel. So the first vision that he has in this section is as follows. Paragimal Pasuk Aleph, page 2, source 4. Vayar ini Yoshua Kohen Agadol. So God shows me the same Yoshua Kohen Agadol, which is this, we don't know who he is historically, but he's some visionary figure or a person persona that we see. So he showed me, God showed me Yoshua, the great priest, the high priest, Omed lifnei Malach Hashem, standing before the angel of God. Hasatano Omed al Yimini al Yisidno. And there's an image that you have this high priest standing there, or sitting there, right, or standing before the angel of God, right? That same angel explains the prophecies. And right next to him is the Satan. What's he trying to do? Lifnei. So what does that mean? To trip him up, right? Or in context of the book of Eov, remember the very beginning of the book of Eov, Eov is righteous, and he has his whole family, and everyone's successful, and everyone's healthy, and so on and so forth. And who comes to God to prosecute against him? It's the Satan. So Lifnei probably means to prosecute against him. So you have this image of this high priest, connects nicely with HaMikdash and so on and so forth, and you have the Satan standing alongside him, so he's the prosecuting angel. Vayomer Hashem la Satan, God says to angel, fe, right? In other words, as opposed to an Eov, where God says, right, that's a really interesting argument. Let me try that out on Eov and see how he responds, right? And then we have 40 chapters of suffering. So here it's a very different response. God says, Yigar Hashem b'cha Satan, right? So this is how we know God is the first, or one of the major authors that were personas, to refer to himself in the third person, right? So God does that here. God says, right, God will scream at you. Yigar Hashem b'cha b'cheb Yishalayim. Hashem, the one who has chosen you, Yishalayim, has chosen the redemption, has chosen Yoshua as the Kohen Gadol, he's going to scream right back at you, right? I'm going to be the defense attorney. I'm going to yell right back in the courtroom against you for everything you're trying to prosecute against the Jewish people. And what's his explanation? It's fascinating. Halozeh ud mutzal me'esh, which is a classic Hebrew term. This is a man who is a brand plucked from the fire.
Going from the Shoah.
Okay, good. So that's where I'm going. Excellent. But at this time, obviously, it's not a reference to the Shoah in historical context of this Sefer. This is a brand that was plucked from which fire? From the fire of the destruction, the Churban Beis HaMikdash. Turns out Rashi seems to say that he himself was a survivor, but other Mefarshim suggest, and it seems like the historical sources that we now have that complement the story, sound like he was a grandchild, or his parents were survivors, the second generation. But he's a brand plucked from the fire. He's a second generation survivor. And God says, I'm not going to be punishing a second generation survivor on my watch. That's not how I treat an Ud Mutzal Me'esh. The Yeshua Hagal Lavush Begadim Soem. Not only that, but he was wearing these soiled clothing, which for any of the Farshim say, he was not only physically imperfect or had been spoiled, as it were, by the horrors and devastation of the Churban, but probably also that he was sinful. That he was spiritually tainted or dirtied, as it were. The omed milfei malach, standing before the angel. Vayayan vayomer vayomer l'adun l'fanav le'mor hasiru habagadim asurim mi'alav. Take off, remove the soiled clothing. Vayomer love re'ei avarti mi'alecha avonecha. I removed from you, and this is where they get it from, that it was sinful. Your sin. It says explicitly your sin. It sounds like it wasn't just that he was survivor, but that he was an imperfect choice for Kohen Gadol. This is not a pure or ideal choice. Remember the second base of Mikdash, there are many Kohanim Gadolim who are not necessarily perfect, who are far from perfect. He's a good person, it sounds like, but he's sinful, like we all are. And nonetheless, God says that he's going to choose him, perhaps precisely because of the symbolism of that. In other words, I want a survivor. This is the right person who's going to be chosen as my candidate. I gave you new clothing, I gave you essentially a beautiful tiara for your head, and he dresses him this way, and he says, basically, if you stand before me and do my will, then you're going to be judged favorably and be successful according to God. Okay, so that's image number one. The second image over here that catches us up with, and then we'll have read these two chapters essentially, or at least got an overview of these two chapters in Zechariah. He says the second one is of a stone. And this is the top of page 3. He says, Hineh ha'evin asher natati lefnei Yoshua, the stone that I placed before Yoshua, the Kohen Gadol, al evin echad shiva'inayim. It's a stone with 7 eyes. Stone with 7 eyes. Hineni mefatech mitpitucha. What? Sorry, I'm on the top of page 3, pasuk 10. Perikimol pasuk 10. Ya, hineh ha'evin asher natati lefnei Yoshua, al evin echad shiva'inayim. 7 eyes and a single stone. Hineni mefatech pitucha. He says, I'm going to craft it. I'm going to wipe out the sins. And then he says, and ultimately what I'm going to do is this, again, a messianic sort of image. I'm going to call everyone under his vine, under his fig tree, very much reminiscent of the other prophets. Okay, so this is the other image that he gives. Now, the seven parts you have, what do you have here in summary, then in Zubah, in Zechariah, putting these chapters together, is you have number one, an image of Yoshua Kohen Gadol, who is a survivor who has soiled clothing. God says, forget you, Satan, fare away with you. I'm going to nonetheless choose him as the representative of Jewish people, number one. Number two, he's compared to, Zerubbabel's reign is compared to, this imagery of the seven-eyed stone. Very striking kind of image, seven-eyed stone. That's number two. Number three is later on, what do we come to? The imagery of the menorah. How many branches does the menorah have? Also, intentionally, very clearly, seven. And in fact, at the end of, and then at the end, he says that's symbolic of lo v'chayov, lo v'choch. It's not a force, because remember, this is Zechariah, who's not about physical labor, but it's about, it's the religious Zionist, right? It's the spiritual side of that project. And he says that's going to be the sign of God's presence in all of this. And he even says explicitly, and many of the Farshim echo this idea, that what are these seven eyes? And what are even, right? These are the eyes of, that represent God's eyes, as it were, looking out over the world, right? And the menorah also here seems to be a symbol of God's, what should we call, hashgacha, God's providence. God is looking out. So you have a stone, which represents the base of the Beis HaMikdash, probably, right? Presumably, or something like that. And that stone is infused with the eyes of God. Yeah.
It's interesting. It's beautiful what you're saying, of course, but the English translation, seven facets, so they've gone away completely from the eye thing.
Yeah, I don't like this translation at all. It's JPS, and I don't know why they kind of... I mean, I understand kind of maybe see eyes in a stone seems like an unusual image, but I mean, we're talking about a Navi here, and Zechariah has... If you think this is a bizarro... Right. I mean, this is... Right, he has all sorts of just a very exotic, I mean, sorry, God forbid, in a derogatory way, but he has all sorts of exotic images. I mean, he's got all sorts of interesting things. So Zechariah is one of the most unusual and strange sets of prophecies. Yeah, I saw that word. I stayed away from it. Yeah, but they... What? No, I'd be curious to ask the editors of the Tanakh where they got it from or what motivated them. But it's not the only place. I don't mean this as a general phenomenon in JPS Tanakh, but I am just going to observe that there's another instance. I remember a Pasuk where there seems to be this idea of someone who can gain insight into the counsel of God. And there's almost a sense of spiritual insight for someone who's attuned to God's wisdom. And they seem to kind of rationalize it almost, mm-hmm. as if to kind of stay away from the idea that if, mm-hmm. with wisdom you can kind of get a mystical intuition about God's will. I don't know if there's consistency or not, but yeah, I did notice that as well. Okay, so that's the prophecy. So clearly what Zechariah is trying to do in complementing the message of Haggai, who has a Hanukkah message as well, right? That's the timing over here. Clearly what Zechariah is doing is he's giving this imagery of the menorah, and this is the idea that God will be present in the rebuilding efforts. If the Jews put in their effort with Haggai, then ultimately ki im beruchi, that God's spirit, and that's the connection between the Sfar. That's clearly the imagery of Zechariah. Not only that, but he's saying, I think, that God shows favor to the Jewish people at this time. It's almost like he recognizes the suffering, the struggle, and so on and so forth. And that's why he has mercy on the Kohen Gadol, because he's a second-generation survivor, and that's part of the Hashgacha comes from, that we've suffered so much, no more. Now God is going to be present for us. Mm-hmm. So that takes us, what I think is very beautiful. So that, I think, is what's essentially going on in Chag and Zechariah. What are Chazal doing by connecting it to the holiday of Hanukkah? What do you think?
What do you think of that? Chazal was doing it by connecting to Hanukkah?
Yeah, and by choosing this as the Haftorah.
Well, because it's the reestablishment of Hanukkah Sabbai. It's the same thing that happens after the Chashmonaim reestablished the second base of Mikdash again after its defilement by the Greeks, who were really Hellenized Jews. They're tying it back to the prophecy that the temple would be reestablished in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah.
Beautiful.
At the same time.
Beautiful. And what about the piece of the strength versus the spirit? How does that relate to Hanukkah?
That's the big debate. What is the actual miracle?
Good.
Military versus
very good.
Spiritual. That's why I had to make up that thing with the cruise of wine.
Right.
Cruise of oil, because they weren't so happy, saying the miracle was a military.
Right.
They tried to play that down, clearly, the military elements of the, right, and tried to spiritualize it, at least at that time, which might have in part been because of the Roman Jewish conflicts.
Of course, if you're going to spiritualize the victory, you have to spiritualize the defeat. So it's a lot easier to spiritualize.
No, but I don't know if Rob Simonski meant that it's safer to talk about
spiritual. For sure.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I meant. Sure. Right.
But it could also be connected to the fact that what the Hashanim and being Kohanim and becoming
the kings
sure, go ahead.
Was not something you'd want to highlight given the spiritual, so that by emphasizing the spiritual, you sort of you detract from that, or you sort of hide it a little bit. And I think that could be the part of it as well.
That could fit as well.
Not happy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On the other hand, they made
us. There's a very mixed.
Yeah, sure. On the other hand, they made us put up the menorah publicly, so you could identify who was a supporter of the Chashma of the Hasmonean house and who wasn't. You know.
Well, I think also attitudes shifted over time.
Oh, I think that's
a big part of it.
He's putting up menorah river, which is definitely a political statement.
Yeah, it's interesting. This woman who came last year, Malka Simkovich, is a scholar of this time period. And so she has a lot to say about Hanukkah. In fact, I have to look back. I didn't get a chance to read it yet, but I saw that she posted something. Because she's actually, you know, like, you hear all these Divrei Torah, but she actually knows really historically what was happening. She knows the primary documents. She read the Book of Maccabees and really analyzed it seriously. She's published around it. Like, this is what she does. This is her area. Someone this is their professional work, to be looking at Hanukkah from that lens, I think it has a lot of potential. So looking forward to hearing her insights on this. Okay. So I think all that is right. So that's in terms of the connections. That's the internal meaning of Chagai and Zechariah. That, I think, is the connection that Chazal drawing. What do you think about the last piece? So what's the symbolism then? What comes over to the state of Israel? So we heard about the connection to the Shoah, which I think is one of the most striking things, right? I mean, you have this imagery of the brand plucked from the fire. And some of the modern Israeli works or sort of recountings of elements of the Holocaust have actually explicitly borrowed from this imagery.
Okay.
And actually have borrowed from this imagery, this Ud, this brand plucked from the fire, the Ud Mutzal Me'ish. You take a look, you actually see this. And that's these interviews with survivors and so on and so forth. Rav Amital, who was the head of Gush for many years, he used this imagery. He entitled some of his drashot about his survival from the Holocaust. Ud Mutzal Me'ish. So that's definitely one part of it. But what else do you guys think? What are the other connections? What's the meaning? What were you learning in YU? Yeah. What were you learning in YU?
Okay. Yeah, what was
that? A lot, I'm sure.
No, the idea of the founding of the state is, again, yet another re-establishment of the Jewish commonwealth or a temple or holiness.
Right, so it's that said about,
yeah.
Right? So this would be true about modern Israel. Okay.
People forget, we almost never study Ezra Nefendi, Chagai, and Malachi. It's a shame, because it's something like, if you count the Parakim, it's somewhere, something about 15% of the whole Tanakh is that period, which almost is never studied. But there's
I think it's much more than that. But
it's not a small thing, if you look at all. But there is also part of the feeling, I think, that there was a degree of disappointment. Here they have Zerubbabel is coming back. He's supposed to be reestablishing the Messianic era there at that time. And actually, he never does become a king. He becomes, at best, a satrap of the Persian Empire. And I think there's a similar rejoicing, but quasi-disappointment with Chashmonaim, who never really establish, they get free of the Seleucids, but only at the cost of becoming subservient to the Romans. By the time of, the children of the Chashmonaim, they have to make an alliance with the Romans to actually really
clean. You think they're trying?
And it's the same thing now, really, to some degree. They're, we say Rishus Nichakulatena, but I think that there's a certain, the Third Temple hasn't been reestablished. And I think that one of the realities of the reestablishment of the state, all three of these times, is that it's a partial gula so far, and it was for them too. It's important to remember that it was for them too.
I don't know where in the Gemara and how reflectivism. But this is 200 years later where the Gemara says, they knew that the second base Midrash wasn't equal to the first. I mean, there are many things
right,
missing from...
Gadol HaMai says that, right?
They didn't have the Aaron, they didn't have this, they didn't have that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They didn't know when that statement, the last Navi Malachi. When the second temple is reestablished, that's the end of Nevuah B'Yisrael. You know, the last
Malachi. So Chazal say it later. I mean, at least the record of it in the Gemara comes from later, but... And they knew they were struggling with this from day one. There's no question about it. That's all right. And I think just to complement what you were just saying, I think also the sense that kimi vazliyam ktanot, the idea that just the same point, but on the inverse, that even a small beginning could be a really meaningful one. Like, this is a fledgling state. I think they were still at war in February 1949. I mean, this is...
Still at war.
Right? I'm saying, but they're keeping that. Right? So, you know, I think that that's all right. I wonder if part of it is also that they're kind of saying, like, we kind of feel like this. In other words, I'm saying the same thing that was what I was going to respond earlier. I don't think at that time they were thinking in a negative sense. In other words, they were thinking about that, but in a hopeful sense. Like now, at this point in 2017, so I think there's after 70 years, it's more mixed, it's more complicated. But I think in 1948-49, I suspect that it might have been the same message, but just with a different key or on the inverse. So sort of, we shouldn't downplay or diminish the significance of this and what it can lead to. It can lead to full-on redemption. I think it's a beautiful, beautiful message. Okay. Any other connections that you can see? I think we got most of them.
Go ahead. Simple though. One thing you didn't mention.
Mm-hmm. Sorry.
It's a shield too.
No, let's go make sure. What, the Hebrew or the English? Let's see.
No, in the picture.
That's the last thing I was going to talk about, which is the menorah and the olive branch. That's right. It's a coat of arms. Right?
But that's Western heraldry.
I was going to say, I don't know.
No, state symbols have
So it's hard to know because. It is tricky. But I think what's clear though is that. Right, I mean, they were giving the olive branches as the sign of peace. I do think that fits nicely. This is the flip side to what you're saying, right? That fits nicely with the idea of the menorah as ki imbruchi, lo v'chayel v'lo v'chach. To me, this is the same thing, right? It's lo v'chayel v'lo v'chach, ki imbruchi. And it's almost as if the fledgling state of Israel is saying to the outside world, they're announcing themselves to say, look, you may perceive us, right? I mean... Right, nothing ever changes here either, right? You may perceive us as a military force or as violent, but that's not at all our desire. In fact, we want the light of the menorah. We want kiyum bruchi, lo v'chayav lo v'chas, not what we desire, right? We seek peace. We are adding the olive branches. They adorn our menorah. That's exactly what ultimately that image is all about. But alas, we have no choice because our enemies seek to drive us into the sea and we're not suicidal, so we're going to pick up arms and we're going to bear arms and we're not going to allow another Holocaust to happen, right? So we're doing what we need to do because it's the right thing to do, but don't think that we don't desire to live in a world that is kiyum beruchi, which I think is a beautiful message as well. So I think brought together, I think there's a stunning way in which we see the connection over the generations. And I think to me, it's a beautiful, inspiring message about Tanakh, and about its ongoing and eternal resonance. And I think it's a very beautiful symbol. And I think it's a beautiful message for Hanukkah, that ultimately Hanukkah, then we see in turn, really is a time where we say it's true that the Hashmonaim had to pick up arms, and it's true that they had to be violent, and that's part of the Zionist legacy, and we're proud that when we need to, then we are willing and to stand up and to defend ourselves. Tzahal in the whole nine yards. At the same time, though, there's the recognition that kiyum bruchi, that ultimately our greatest desire is peace, and that really is the legacy of Chagai and Zechariah. That's the legacy of the ideal of the Maccabim, at least, and the ideal of vision of Hanukkah. And ultimately, it's the ideal vision of the modern state of Israel as well. So I think it all comes together beautifully. And I wish everyone a Chag Sameach, a Hanukkah Sameach.